Good afternoon again, Justices. May it please the Court, I'm Janet Wright, and I represent the State Public Integrity Commission. As you know, we're here today because the Superior Court overturned the commission's...
Can you talk into the mic? It's hard to hear you.
See if this is better for a short person. Can you hear me now, Your Honor?
Better.
Thank you.
And that podium will go down, I think, if you need to lower it.
I think I'm good, but I might accidentally hit it later and take care of that problem myself. Thank you. The reason the commission has appealed this decision is because it believes there were numerous errors made by the court when it overturned the decision that Diane Hansen, a Dewey Beach town commissioner and subsequently mayor of the town, participated in a decision on an ordinance that she had a personal or private interest in. The commission identified those interests as the properties that she rents in Dewey Beach, which are basically just across the highway from Dewey Beach Enterprises. And the ordinance itself only applied to Dewey Beach Enterprises, and the ordinance would keep Dewey Beach Enterprises from building above 35 feet.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
What was the result of the commission's finding? What happened? What
the
sanctions?
The sanction was a reprimand.
A reprimand.
That is all the commission can do if it's an elected official.
So this is for the purpose of clearing the air as far as Hansen is concerned?
This should be the end of it.
And from the commission standpoint, this is being appealed because there's a principal involved or what?
Well, one of the things that it is concerned about is, first of all, one of the things the court ruled on that the commission believes was in error is the court said that PIC should have held a full trial proceeding. However, that ignored the fact that PIC has adopted the Superior Court rules of procedure, and it followed those rules. And those rules are that on a motion to dismiss, if additional materials outside the motion are included, then it's treated as a matter for summary judgment.
That's right. I thought the thrust of Justice Berger's question, and it's certainly a question that I have, is what really is at stake here? Ms. Hansen, had suffered the embarrassment of having a reprimand that was undone legally in the Superior Court, and now we're up here. As a practical matter, whichever way this case comes out, what's at stake?
Well, what's at stake is the commission's ability to follow the procedures that it believes were proper, also have it clarified by this court regarding issues such as challenges against an individual's affidavit, and also the concerns about other issues of laws, such as the
this sort of a hodgepodge. I mean, are we talking about a principle, or are we talking about a principle plus procedures, or principle, procedures, and something else?
Talking about principles and procedures.
I thought the Superior Court ruled that there was not substantial evidence in support of the PIC's decision.
It ruled that, but it also ruled that PIC did not follow its own rules regarding the procedure and that it should have had a full trial. And that's one of the commission's concern, is that on a motion to dismiss, it would like for this court to clarify and affirm that it proceeded properly, because on a motion to dismiss, again, as I said, it can be converted to a motion for summary judgment, and from that point, the additional testimony that Ms. Hansen presented would be included, and then the commission could determine and did determine there were no issues of fact remaining, and following Delaware law.
So are you or are you not challenging the conclusion of the Superior Court that substantial evidence was not in the record?
We're also challenging that, Your Honor, because the errors of the court impacted on whether or not they were substantial evidence.
But did the court make two holdings or only one? As I read the decision, it appears that the court decided there was not substantial evidence and rested its decision on that, although it may have also commented on its view of the procedures that were followed. Was there a holding to that effect?
It was a holding that PIC did not follow its own procedures. And then there was a separate holding that there was not substantial evidence to support its decision.
Well, we'll see.
Were they separate holdings, or did the court, in making its ultimate holding that there was no substantial evidence, made reference to the procedures in order to determine that some of the evidence, you know, was basically not admissible or cognizable?
Well, that's why I say that these two parallel tracks overlap, because the errors that were made in reaching the decision that it didn't follow procedures overlapped into the finding that there wasn't substantial evidence. For example, in saying that it should have had a trial proceeding, it noted that the commission did not call the individual who filed the complaint, Mr. Nelson, as a witness. From that, it concluded that his testimony was not persuasive, that he didn't testify, and so it was proof of nothing. As a result of that, it said there wasn't substantial evidence to prove what he was alleging. Problem with that was that it ignored the commission rules that, first of all, it can entertain hearsay allegations, which court also said it was, because its rules permit it. The second thing was that as far as him testifying, like I said, we were not following trial procedures. We were following the procedures for a summary judgment act, in which case we wouldn't have called him.
Well, let me understand this. You're saying that you were deciding this as if it was a motion for summary judgment?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But at the same time, there was some kind of a hearing, wasn't there?
That's right. On the day that the commission scheduled to hear the motion to dismiss, Ms. Hansen appeared with two witnesses, and although they had raised the question before as to whether they could have a witness testify, no witness was ever testified, and then on the day of the hearing, three people were identified. They were there and ready to testify. The court looked at its rules, which allow it to expedite procedures, and it went ahead and let them testify. And then they asked that the testimony be incorporated into their motion.
Well, that sounds a little bit strange to me. The way I understand it, under the court's rules of civil procedure, if there is a motion for summary judgment or a motion to dismiss that includes record evidence outside of the pleadings, then the court looks at the record evidence for both sides and makes a determination whether there are material issues of fact in dispute and whether the moving party is entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. I have never heard of having a hearing of some sort in terms of adducing facts at a hearing in connection with a motion for summary judgment. The whole point of summary judgment is that you've got your record and you're asking the court to rule on that record.
I understand that, Your Honor, but that was made at the request of Ms. Hansen, and like I said, the commission looked at its rules, which is similar to the Superior Court Rule 16, and concluded it could expedite the proceedings if it went ahead and heard the testimony. And then upon their request, we did incorporate that, and it was reviewed as to whether or not there was any issue of fact remaining.
Is it accurate that the PIC's findings were based on Nelson's complaint, an article in the Cape Gazette, Hansen's advertisement and tax records for her rental properties, the federal case settlement agreement and district court decision, and maps of Dewey Beach?
In part, yes. But primarily, as far as his complaint, the commission, independent of what he filed, ascertained the street addresses of the property that she owned, which she has never disputed and, in fact, confirmed during her testimony, that as far as the allegation of there being a federal case where she had been sued by Dewey Beach, that was independently confirmed by the federal court's decision, which specifically said there is a lawsuit against her personally alleging a conflict of interest. So the documents were provided for those purposes, and they were never objected to.
But was there any other factual record other than what I just indicated?
The testimony.
Of whom?
of Ms. Hansen and her attorneys. She testified confirming that she rents the properties. She never disputed that those properties were right across the highway, and in fact she talked herself about the fact that they were across Route 1, and so people didn't like to cross that highway. As far as the lawsuit itself, she confirmed, as did her attorneys, that she was sued in federal court. As far as the commission's conclusion at its preliminary hearing that the ordinance was meant as a defense, both of her attorneys testified that it was meant as a defense in the federal suit, the ordinance on which she sponsored and voted on. And her private attorney testified that it was after her motion to dismiss had been denied for the federal court that he talked to her about the ordinance being a defense to the lawsuit. So she had already lost all of those defenses, and this created a new defense. And but for her vote, because it was a 3-2 vote, but for her vote, it would not have been passed and created a defense.
That's right. I'm sorry.
You are anxious, apparently, to have this court explain how the commission is supposed to operate and what rules it's supposed to live by and so forth, although I'm not 100% sure that that's a proper function for this court on appeal. But be that as it may, am I correct that the commission, under its own rules, has to make its finding on clear and convincing evidence?
The standard at the preliminary hearing is reasonable belief that a violation may have occurred, which is basically
right,
probable cause.
Right, that's not
cause.
What I'm talking about.
And then on at the final hearing, then it is clear and convincing. In this case, it was clear and convincing because the only evidence.
Okay, I'm not asking about what you say supports that. You agree that the standard is clear and convincing.
Yes, Your Honor,
evidence.
I do.
Typically, an appeal from an administrative decision on the record is reviewed for substantial evidence, and we have lots of case law explaining that substantial evidence doesn't really mean a whole lot of evidence. Okay, is there a different standard when you are reviewing a decision that had to be based upon clear and convincing evidence as opposed to a decision that only had to be made based upon a preponderance of the evidence?
Now, the court's review, as indicated in the code of conduct, is that it will be reviewed for substantial evidence. That's what it says if a person appeals
okay.
the
okay.
decision.
What I'm trying to get at is a slightly finer point here. If there is any evidence to support an administrative body's decision, then review for substantial evidence passes.
Right.
When you've got a decision by the administrative body that has to be based on clear and convincing evidence, does the substantial evidence review by a court have to be at a higher level in terms of what evidence there is to support the administrative body's decision?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of anything that holds that way.
So it's your position that the same type of minimal review for substantial evidence is appropriate even where your standard for making a finding is clear and convincing evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, and I base that specifically on Section 5810.
If that's true,
substantial evidence.
If that's true, then you can have a situation where there may be quote, substantial evidence to support a finding, but that evidence would not be clear and convincing. So, you know, if that is the case, how can this court, on review, apply the simple substantial evidence test?
Because the General Assembly made it clear that it's the substantial evidence review. I understand the dilemma that you're talking about, but the commission can only go by those words.
Let me express another concern that I have. Yeah, by the time a case gets up to this court, there are only four arguments that the appellant can make. The appellant can either argue that the trial court chose the wrong rule of law, which is a de novo standard of
Correct.
Review, the appellant can argue that the trial court got the right rule of law but applied it incorrectly to the facts. That's also de novo. The appellant can argue that the court found the facts incorrectly, which I understand is one of the arguments you're making.
Correct.
And lastly, the appellant can argue that the court abused its discretion.
Correct.
Where are we? What else are you arguing here besides that the court found the facts?
That's exactly where we are.
Where? There are four possibilities. One of them has been identified.
The court committed errors of law.
Would you let me finish my question?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
I understand that you're saying the court erred in finding that there was no evidence to support the factual findings. And I guess what we have to determine is whether there was evidence.
Correct.
How much evidence is another question. Are you also arguing separately that the court made errors of law that we can review de novo?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they are precisely what? When I read your brief, it sounds like a trial brief. I mean, it's all over the place, I hate to say. And I can't make heads or tails of what legal propositions you're presenting to us.
Well, specifically, aside from there's more than one argument where the court imposed elements of the law that are not within the statutory framework of the Code of Conduct provisions. For example, the error that the court made that's reflected in its final conclusion is that the court said the reason why she voted as she did, and went on to talk about that, motive is not an element of the Code of Conduct provision, so there was an error of law in trying to impose a requirement for PIC to rule on a motive.
All right, so the one error of law is that the court should have found that there was a violation by her simply having voted, regardless of what motive she had.
Motive is not an element. It's whether or not the person okay. has a personal or private.
That argument depends on the finding that there was a conflict. And
Correct.
The court found there wasn't any fact to support a conflict. So that argument, I guess, falls by the wayside unless we agree with you that there was evidence of a conflict of interest at the time of the vote.
Well, there was evidence, and the reason the court erred is because it never applied the elements as the commission did to the law, and that's another error. The law is that if you have a personal or private interest, and the evidence, all of the evidence, was that she had both those personal or private
interests. Excuse me, I just want to remind you, you're into your rebuttal time.
Okay.
But if you want to use it, you're welcome to.
Okay. I'll hold off. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, David Finger for appellee. Mayor Diane Hansen with me at council table is Mr. Slanina and Mayor Hansen. I'd like to respond by addressing a couple of questions that Your Honors have raised. First is the question of whether it is a substantial evidence question or a procedural question. And it is our position that it is essentially a substantial evidence issue. The procedural issue is essentially superfluous if one stripped away from the Superior Court decisions, those discussions. What would remain would be the substantial evidence test. And if Your Honors find that there's no substantial evidence, then the procedural issue becomes moot. Similarly, if Your Honors somehow find there is substantial evidence, the procedural issue becomes moot.
Let me ask your view on the business about clear and convincing evidence.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is it your position that that requires some higher level of substantial evidence review?
I would suggest yes, Your Honor, but not just for that reason. For one other reason, the evidence before the commission was uncontradicted. There were no witnesses put forth by commission counsel. And therefore, there is no issue of credibility of competing witnesses. And Your Honor, this court is in as good a shape to look at that uncontradicted evidence and determine its applicability as the trial court or the administrative agency. Just as on summary judgment, this is a bizarre summary judgment idea, but if they consider summary judgment, that's reviewed de novo because the record is such that there's an issue that there shouldn't be any contradiction of facts, and the court can determine whether under the law the evidence.
So it's your position that under all the facts that were presented to the commission, which included both the newspaper articles and things like that, as well as your client's testimony and the attorney's testimony, that's the sum total of all the evidence, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And as I understand it, that evidence established by clear and convincing evidence what properties your client owned, where they were located in relation to the Ruddertown development, and other arguably essential facts to support a finding of a conflict of interest. Is it your position that those facts weren't enough to establish a conflict of interest?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Let me attack discuss the specific conflicts found and why there's no evidence. First, they claimed there was a conflict because the vote allegedly helped her in her defense in the federal lawsuit. There was no evidence presented about the effect. There was no expert evidence about the law of federal civil procedure law.
Well, wait a second. I thought her attorneys agreed that they advised her that this new ordinance would be helpful for the federal lawsuit.
That's incorrect, Your Honor. Her lawyer testified, they asked, after she voted for it, did they discuss it? The lawyer said, I'm sure we discussed it, but he never said what the result of that discussion was. Judge Bradley, in his opinion, goes into detail explaining he could have said it's an absolute defense or it's no defense whatsoever. The inference to be drawn from that is
so
unreasonable.
You're saying that there is no record evidence, whether it's from Hansen herself or anyone else, that indicates that attorneys advised that this ordinance would or could be helpful in the federal litigation.
As to her personal defense, that's correct.
No, I'm talking generally.
Yes. The attorney for the town of Rehoboth, or town of Dewey Beach, said that it would be helpful to the town's defenses, which are separate from the qualified immunity defense, which applies to the officials. So there's a distinction there.
Okay, fine.
Mr. Finger, before we leave the issue of clear and convincing evidence, my understanding of the trial court's opinion is that there was no evidence to support the findings that were made, and that was the ground for reversal. I don't recall, but I may be wrong, the court alluding to clear and convincing evidence. That is, did that element form part of the analysis? Am I missing something here?
Your Honor, the court noted in, I believe in a footnote, that under the PIC rules, there must be a finding by clear and convincing evidence.
Right.
However, the trial court simply used the substantial evidence test and found that the evidence presented did not support the conclusion reached.
In other words, if there's no substantial evidence, there can't be clear and convincing evidence.
I think by definition, Your Honor.
I'd like to focus on the concluding paragraph in the trial court's decision, which begins with what seems to me a fairly interesting statement. There are two views of the evidence in this case. One view is that Hansen voted for the clarifying ordinance in order to help her rental properties compete with DVE's hotel to improve her legal defenses. The other view is that Hansen voted because she was opposed to the project because of the height. PIC chose the former instead of the latter. The issue is whether that choice is supported by substantial evidence. I've concluded that it is not. The court starts out saying that there are two views of this evidence. If there are two views of this evidence, isn't the administrative body that's making the decision the one that decides which view they accept?
Well, let me begin to answer that question first by saying I agree with Ms. Wright that motive is irrelevant. It's not a statutory consideration. The question is whether there was an actual conflict. And I believe that what Judge Bradley was saying was that one could find one of two options. However, again, the question is, do the evidence permit the inference? Because these decisions are based on inferences, not on hard facts.
But the court says there are two views of the evidence in this case. If there are two views, it means that there's support for both sides.
That may be so, but in the first instance, the court should not divorce that last paragraph from everything that came before it. The court discusses the evidence at length and explains why it does not rise to the level of substantial evidence.
Well, could the court have misspoken?
Very easily.
Can I finish my question?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Is it possible that the court was saying there are two, theoretically, there are two opposite inferences that might be drawn from this evidence? They are A and B, but there is no substantial evidence to support, you know, whatever the A or B, you know, whatever the commission relied on.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we cite authority, not Delaware, obviously, but authority in the briefs that point out where evidence leads to two equally plausible inferences, and they're in equipoise, then to choose one is not a reasonable inference. And in this case, it is speculation. Because Pink did not have any information, for example, about how federal rights law would be, the qualified immunity defense would be affected by the vote, the fact that the lawyer says that we talked about it but doesn't say how allows an equal inference that he said it was an absolute defense, and the equal inference that it says it's no defense. And when you choose one of those two without that connecting bit of logic, it becomes speculation. And if I just give a quick example, the lawyers here know that this court is going to at some point discuss this case and vote how to decide. However, the fact that we know that this court is going to talk about it doesn't mean that we know how it's going to rule. And if we were to say it's an inference that the court could rule one way or the other, it's pure speculation, even though there are two possible inferences to be drawn. The same is true for the property values. There's an important point of the statute. The statute says that she has to have a benefit different from others similarly situated. A large part of the population of Dewey are landlords. They rent property. And they are affected the same way in terms of property values by this vote as she is. Pick attempted to narrow the number of the class by saying she's not only a property holder, but she's a property holder who's a commissioner. However, her property values are not affected by the fact that she's a commissioner, so they unduly restricted the class without any
Well, reason. I mean, the ruling by the trial court was that, you know, that the commission could have been right if Ms. Hansen owned and rented property in the same area, the geographical relevant area, as the project that was going up and being constructed. But Ms. Hansen, I believe, owned beachfront property. The property being constructed was bay property. There's a highway separating them. It's a different market. And therefore, even though they are both competing in the sense that they're renting property to somebody, they're different. It's a different market. And therefore, there is no meaningful competition.
Correct, Your Honor. And in addition, as the Superior Court pointed out, it was not an apples-to-apples comparison made between these types of hotel rooms and houses. So they found that the PIC had not done an adequate job of establishing apples-to-apples in this case.
They're renting the house is on the beachfront, right?
Yeah, the house on the beachfront.
So it's a much more upscale type of rental than renting a hotel room on the Bayside.
Right, and there's also at least anecdotal evidence in the transcript of one person who was willing to pay more money to be on that side of Route 1 than on the other side. Now, of course,
I'm curious, do any of the other members of the commission own rental property in Dewey Beach?
I cannot answer that, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that question, although I know that one member of the commission is a realtor, but whether she's also a landlord, I don't know. And finally, there was this issue they raised. They found conflicts of interest because she was voting to protect a quality of life. or and they raised the issue of appearance of impropriety. I respectfully submit that those issues find no basis in the statute.
They're not on the legal radar screen, I think.
They shouldn't be, Your Honor. Yeah. And, of course, again, as to the procedural points, the only thing that may be relevant, there was an unsworn complaint, and Ms. Wright points out that administrative agencies can rely on hearsay. However, this Court has indicated that there are limits to that as well. For example, an administrative agency cannot base its decision solely, exclusively on hearsay. And here is, we go beyond that, which is the issue of this
Court. Well, is this really an issue? I mean, the Court didn't, at least I didn't read the opinion, this concluding, you know, reaching any conclusion based on the fact that the complaint or the affidavit was unsworn. Why are we talking about it?
Well, I'm responding only in this instance to Ms. Wright's suggestion that it somehow affected the evidentiary mix. But I'm happy to go away from that. And unless Your Honors have any other questions, I'm content to rest.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, and I would like to start by answering your question regarding whether or not any of the commissioners own and rent any properties at the beach. The commissioners who rendered this decision, the only one that had any connection to real estate was Barbara Green. She is a realtor in Rehoboth Beach. She sells properties in Rehoboth Beach. She does not even take clients from any place else, just people who are looking to buy in Rehoboth Beach. That is the only connection to any properties in that area.
So you're saying that the record would establish that no other commissioner was in the business of renting out beach property in Dewey Beach?
That is correct.
And where is that in the record?
Well, it's not in the record because nobody ever asked the question except for it was posed by the media that perhaps somebody had a personal interest. I ask all of my commissioners specifically, even before we get into it, do any of you have a conflict? Then when that appeared in the paper, I specifically said, let's go through this again. Do any of you own any properties or rent any properties or have any connection to the town of Dewey Beach or any other properties down there? And they said no. That is not in the record.
Thank you.
Do you care to comment on the distinction between a hotel room on the bayside and beachfront property?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. First of all, Ms. Hansen rents a condo. Dewey Beach Enterprises is not only just renting a hotel, it is also going to provide condos. So there is a likeness there. The other thing is, you know, she said that it impacted on the quality of life because it would...
Wait, you say she owns and rents a condo, but is it still beachfront?
It is still beachfront. So the people who rent at Dewey Beach Enterprises would have to cross the highway to get to her beach, but they're only one block away. And sure, nobody likes to cross a highway, but I mean the border street, Van Dyke, is the boundary of her property and DBE. They cross right there, and they're on her beach.
Thank you. Did you want to ask me? Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement and recess.
Adjourn.